Chapter 4. Travel Writing. Learning is acquired by reading books, but the much more necessary learning, the knowledge of the world, is only to be acquired by reading men and studying all the various editions of them. Earl of Chesterfield, Letters to His Son. During his 1748 surveying trip to the Shenandoah, George Washington kept a journal which vividly displays his personal outlook at 16. A blend of unusual incident and quotidian detail, this, his earliest known journal, reveals Washington's curiosity, literary taste, and love of the land. The content of his journal resembles the travel books in his teenage library. In other words, what Washington wrote reflects what he liked to read. Previously, he had traveled little, but his first trip to the Shenandoah opened his eyes to the vast potential of the American continent. The journal shows him appreciating the land to the west in terms of both agriculture and aesthetics, its bounty and its beauty. One page records with delight a handsome grove of sugar maples. Another conveys his perception of the richness and fertility of the soil, its nearly boundless capacity for growing grain, hemp, and tobacco. Washington's limited backwoods experience led him into some embarrassing greenhorn mistakes. Given a choice between sleeping outdoors on the ground and sleeping indoors in a bed one night, he chose in over out. As his fellow surveyors stayed outside, he entered a rustic cabin, certain he had made the better bargain. Relating the episode in his journal, Washington created an incisive, albeit self-effacing, portrait. Once indoors, he prepared for bed by removing his clothes in an orderly fashion. Climbing into bed, he discovered that it consisted of a few handfuls of straw loosely matted together. In lieu of bedsheet and quilt, a threadbare blanket supplied the only covers. Worse yet, the blanket was infested, in his words, with double its weight of vermin, such as lice, fleas, etc. Though vermin-filled beds were a problem in some of colonial America's finest homes, the presence of lice and fleas in this tumble-down cabin reinforces the traditional association between poverty and pests. That evening, Washington endured the creepy-crawly bedding as long as he could, but finally the bugs got the better of him. He stood up, unfolded his clothes, put them on, and went outdoors to spend the rest of the night sleeping on the ground with his companions, whom he undoubtedly found chuckling over his rookie mistake. In the future, Washington promised himself, he would sleep by a fire in the open air before he would ever sleep indoors under such squalid conditions. During this wilderness experience, Washington grew accustomed to unexpected inconvenience. Coming to supper one day, his fellow surveyors found neither table linen nor silverware, but they seemed undaunted. As Washington told the story, the men hardly minded at all. They simply unsheathed their hunting knives and used them as impromptu eating utensils. Forced to eat without plates another day, they used big chips of wood instead. Washington's account of the incident celebrates the joys of camping. Their campsite that evening marked the edge of civilization. Though they chose a site in some woods near a wild meadow, the meadow contained a large haystack, which let them feed their horses and soften their camp beds. Once they pitched the tents and built a large fire, they prepared for dinner. It was every man for himself that evening. The men skewered venison steaks with forked sticks, broiled them, and then plated the steaks on some slab-like wood chips. The fullest entry in Washington's 1748 journal concerns an encounter with a Native American war party. In late March, a group of Indians returning from a campaign surprised him and the others. Pleasantly surprised them, that is. The Indians greeted the surveyors cordially, but could not mask their disappointment with the recent war campaign, having obtained only one scalp, a gruesome fact Washington noted with nonchalance. Loosening up after a few drinks, the Indians agreed to demonstrate a war dance. Washington recorded the event in detail. His journal entry constitutes an important first-hand account of Native American music and dance. Upon clearing a large circle, the Indians built a bonfire in the middle. They seated themselves around it before one made a grand speech, telling the others how to dance. Once he finished, the best dancer among them jumped up like someone instantly awoken from a deep sleep and darted about the ring in a comical manner. The other dancers followed suit, all performing with vigorous musical accompaniment. One of the musicians pounded a drum made from deerskin stretched tightly across a pot half filled with water. Another rattled a gourd filled with shot and adorned with a piece of a horse's tail. The drummer drummed, the rattler rattled, the dancers danced, and the teenaged Washington watched enthralled. As much as the journal entry reveals about Native American customs, it may say more about Washington's personality. Besides registering his fascination with the folkways of others, it shows his recognition that such customs should be recorded for posterity. The journal entry further indicates his meticulousness. Having made up his mind to record the episode, he did so in detail, capturing both sound and image, going as far as to note precisely how the Indians crafted their musical instruments. Teenage journals typically contain maudlin personal reflections. Washington's account of Native American dance shows that recording the remarkable behavior of others was more important than capturing his personal thoughts. After returning from the Shenandoah, Washington fueled his newfound interest in travel by reading. According to the handwriting style of his ownership inscriptions, he acquired several books of travel in his late teens. Travel literature taught him much about the behavior and customs of people from around the globe. Daniel Defoe's four-volume Tour Through the Whole Island of Great Britain was the most substantial work of travel literature in Washington's small but growing library. Defoe originally published his Tour in the mid-1720s. Washington owned the 1748 edition. That is, the one revised and expanded by Samuel Richardson, the author of Pamela. Each volume in Washington's surviving copy contains brief marginal notes and corrections consistent with those in other books from his library. Most of the marks correct typographical errors. A list of shires in Scotland in the fourth volume, for instance, contains the name Dunbar. Washington supplied the missing suffix in manuscript, changing the place name to Dumbarton. More substantial manuscript annotations occur in the second volume. At one point, Defoe digresses on the British habit of following foreigners in most things, even from the coxcomb in dress up to the historian, referring, for example, to the performance of a late foreign author of the affairs and transactions of this country, whereby the translator and undertakers, to usher it out in English, got at least £10,000, when it had nothing more but rather much less to recommend it than any of our own English histories. Washington underlined the phrase, late foreign author, and wrote Rapin in the margin. He also underlined the word translator, whom he identified as Tyndall in the margin. Washington knew Defoe was talking about Nicholas Tyndall's translation of The History of England by Paul Rapin de Thouars. Rapin's History of England does not appear in any of the catalogs of Washington's library, nor is it mentioned in his papers, but he clearly knew the work. Rapin's history introduced many colonial American readers to Whig history. Though Washington is seldom recognized for his intellectual pursuits, his knowledge of Rapin's history suggests that he, too, read one of the fundamental works that shaped the thought of several founding fathers. Benjamin Franklin, for one, appreciated the thoroughness of Rapin's research and recognize the results of his patience. The author employed 17 years in composing it, and, as he had, by consulting the ancient records of the tower, much better helps than any historian that went before him, it is esteemed the best history of England yet published. Having partially read Richard Baker's Chronicle of the Kings of England, Washington was unwilling to leave his knowledge of English history there. He read Rapin to deepen his understanding. Rapin emphasizes the Saxon roots of liberal democracy and explains that Saxon kings could neither change the laws nor levy taxes at their will. Elsewhere in the second volume of his Tour Through Great Britain, Defoe mentions the man-devil doctrine, too successfully propagated of late years, that private vices are public benefits. Though these phrases were italicized in Defoe's text already, Washington added further emphasis, underlining both man-devil and private vice are public benefits. He also wrote the words fable of the bees in the margin, acknowledging Defoe's reference to Bernard Mandeville's controversial treatise, The Fable of the Bees, or Private Vices, Public Benefits. Washington did not necessarily accept the idea that the pursuit of self-interest contributed to social progress and prosperity. Few of the founding fathers did. But his marginal note reveals his cognizance of Mandeville's argument. Like Rapin's history, Mandeville's famous work is mentioned in neither Washington's library catalog nor his surviving papers. The documentary evidence simply cannot tell the whole story of his literary life. The book culture of colonial Virginia involved much borrowing and lending. Friends loaned Washington copies of books like Rapin and Mandeville, and he loaned friends books from his personal collection. The story of Washington's reading extends well beyond the walls of his library. Virginia Woolf called Defoe's Tour Through Great Britain the sort of book one can read all day, turning the pages as a sheep eats grass. Washington's marginalia in his copy of Defoe's Tour suggests that he enjoyed it similarly, that is, with relaxation and patience. His thorough typographical corrections show that he read the four-volume work page by page, taking the time to read and ponder its text. The book taught him much about Great Britain and demonstrated the power of travel writing in the hands of a master. In the early 18th century, it was not unusual for the title of a book about a particular geographic region to begin with the phrase, "The History and Present State." In terms of its content, if not its form, Defoe's Tour resembles other contemporary works that describe the present state of a nation. It minimizes British history to create an up-to-date picture of Great Britain. Present state books were more well-respected than travel writings. Robert Beverly, for instance, begins The History and Present State of Virginia with a critique of travel writing. "There are no books, the legends of saints always expected, so stuffed with poetical stories as voyages." The fact that Defoe titled and structured his work as a book of travels reflects his confidence in the genre. Furthermore, a book of travels gave Defoe more freedom than either a history or a present state. He did not have to dwell on detail, to count the population, gauge the rainfall, or measure the distance from one place to another. In terms of style, Defoe's Tour comes closer to an essay or a memoir. The essay-like form gave him the freedom to cultivate a personal voice within his national account. Defoe omitted from his story much that was old-fashioned or outmoded. He staunchly avoided explaining natural phenomena in religious terms. Tour Through Great Britain is a thoroughly secular narrative. Instead of characterizing natural occurrences as instances of remarkable providence, He saw them for what they were. Relating what had happened to the cathedral at Chichester, for instance, he explained how lightning had blasted a huge hole in the spire, but left both cathedral and spire standing. The cathedral survived not because of divine providence, but because it was an admirably sound and well-finished piece of workmanship. Man, not God, was the creator responsible for the survival of Chichester Cathedral. Tour Through Great Britain also critiques the stilted, highly artificial writing style that had influenced earlier topographical literature. Defoe especially disliked ornate poetic diction and pastoral imagery. Emphasizing the natural beauty of Salisbury Plain, he used the kind of language that came naturally. Before describing the Thames, he said he would exclude the fanciful detail poets preferred. Instead, he would stress what really made the river glorious, its bridges, docks, fortifications, hospitals, and public buildings. Defoe wrote Tour Through Great Britain in clear, crisp, engaging prose. He stripped away all artifice from the story of Great Britain because he knew the nation could stand on its own without it. So too could its language. Not only does Tour Through Great Britain champion the British nation, it also celebrates the English language. Defoe preferred words derived from Anglo-Saxon over those from Latin. Describing a coastal landmark in Devonshire known as Hercules's Promontory, he expressed his dislike of this Latinate name, calling it what forthright sailors and plain country people called it, Heartland Point, or even better, Hearty Point. Modern muscular English, he saw, provided the best way to describe modern secular England. Defoe's straightforward prose influenced Washington's writing style, as his subsequent travel journals demonstrate. Tour Through Great Britain cherishes British foodways. Describing his visit to Cheddar, Defoe emphasizes the excellence of the cheese that takes its name from the village. Traveling through the North Midlands, he stopped for refreshment and enjoyed some Yorkshire ale, which he found nearly perfect. George Washington, too, enjoyed strong British ale and aged English cheese. Defoe's tour reinforced his tastes. With its contrary qualities, its smooth texture and sharp taste, Double Gloucester was Washington's favorite kind of cheese. The annual orders he sent to Great Britain before the American Revolution include sizable quantities of both cheese and ale. Though devoted to Great Britain, Defoe's tour contains much that appealed to colonial Virginia readers. Volume 4 discusses Scotland, which played a major role in both the history and present state of Virginia. Considering the number of Scots who had emigrated there in search of opportunity, Defoe observed, "Virginia may rather be called a Scots than an English plantation." He also said that the port of Glasgow was ideally suited for importing from and exporting to Virginia. To Defoe's eye, the Virginia trade had helped make Glasgow the finest city in Great Britain after London. Overall, Defoe's discussion of Scotland verifies how essential the story of Virginia was to the history of Great Britain. In light of the American Revolution, Washington's copy of Defoe's Tour Through Great Britain takes on further significance. Among 18th-century readers, Defoe's book fostered a great fondness for the British nation. He painted a charming portrait, displaying what made Great Britain great. Defoe's Britain is a delightful place filled with industrious people who exemplify their nation's finest qualities. As a young man, Washington ardently desired to visit England. Rebelling against Defoe's Britain was a difficult thing for him to do. The presence of Defoe's tour in Washington's library shows that when he rebelled against Great Britain, he rebelled against a nation that represented much he loved. Additional books in his library taught Washington about different parts of the world, A Complete History of the Piratical States of Barbary, which he also acquired in his late teens, combines an English translation of Loger de Tassy's Histoire du Royaume d'Alger with other pertinent matter. The English title identifies the work as a history, but the book is more of a present state, as its author admits in his preface. When it came to Algiers, he explained, I have been the more concise as to the antiquity and revolutions of this kingdom, that I might give a circumstantial detail of its present state. Though the title does not identify the book as a travel narrative, this history achieves authority from the fact that its author was an eyewitness to what he describes. The title page characterizes him as a gentleman who resided there many years in a public character. Reinforcing his reliability, he asserts that travelers can provide a good perspective on the lands they visit. As soon as he makes this assertion, however, he modifies it, clarifying that he meant such business travelers as merchants and traders, those who travel for a reason, not those giddy travelers who are sent abroad from their father's fireside merely to see fine things. The nations of the Barbary coast had previously received much negative press, but Loger de Tassy appears notably open-minded toward Algiers and its neighbors. His preface concludes, I have endeavored to divest myself of all kind of prejudice in order to set the history of these states in a proper light, that my readers may form a true judgment of them by observing the virtues and vices which are blended in their constitutions. Washington, who made open-mindedness a personal trademark, appreciated the stance Loger de Tassy took in his Complete History. Perhaps the book helped determine Washington's attitude. Commodore George Anson's Voyage Round the World, another work Washington acquired in his teens, was the most popular book of travel in colonial America. Some contemporary readers associated it with Robinson Crusoe and Gulliver's Travels. All three captured the imagination of young readers, yet gave them works they could return to as adults. The accounts of Anson's circumnavigation helped fill gaps in the geographical knowledge of its readers. They could follow his changes in latitude and longitude as he and his dwindling squadron circled the earth. The work let young readers practice using their globes as they traced his route. Goethe, for one, read the book as a boy, an experience he fondly recalled in his autobiography, and one that many young 18th-century readers shared. Lord Anson's Voyage Round the Globe combined the dignity of truth with the rich fancies of fable, and while our thoughts accompanied this excellent seaman, we were conducted over all the world and endeavored to follow him with our fingers on the globe. Though typically called Anson's Voyage, the work was not written by Commodore Anson, who led the squadron sent on an expedition to the South Seas during the Anglo-Spanish War to attack Spanish vessels and Spain's colonial settlements. According to the book's title page, the Reverend Richard Walter, chaplain to the expedition, compiled the work, but Benjamin Robbins, a mathematician and engineer, had a hand in its composition as well. Despite who wrote what, the preface to Anson's Voyage follows the critical dictates of the time, stressing that the book would both delight and instruct its readers. Though Anson's Voyage would tell a thrilling tale of adventure, it would also promote navigation, encourage commerce, and advance British national interests. Wherever possible, the narrative corrects misinformation from previous travelers. Most likely, Robbins wrote the passages correcting previous nautical errors. And it must have been Robbins who stressed the importance of a good geographical education. Such emphases appealed to Washington. The narrator of Anson's Voyage laments, "How very imperfect many of our accounts of distant countries are rendered by the relators being unskilled in drawing and in general principles of surveying." These remarks confirmed the career path Washington had chosen and reinforced the value of surveying. Not only did it provide a way for a man to earn his living in the Virginia backcountry, it also gave him a skill useful for exploring faraway lands. Washington never used his knowledge of surveying for this second purpose, but it was a comfort to know he could. The vivid imagery and moving vignettes of Anson's voyage made it stand as one of the masterworks of British travel literature. The narrative of the adventures of Anson's crew paints a picture that combines astonishing beauty with darkly ominous detail, as the trying experiences the sailors undergo near Cape Horn demonstrate. Once the squadron passes the Lemaire Strait near the southern tip of South America, the men felt relieved, assuming the worst was behind them. They were wrong. The work's humanity gives Anson's voyage a touching aspect that quickens the blood and raises goose flesh. It frequently mentions the number of men lost through danger and disease. Scurvy claimed more victims than any other single cause. 2/3 of the way through the story, the narrator relates that only 71 men remained capable of duty, a chilling statistic. This, inconsiderable as it may appear, was the whole force we could collect in our present enfeebled condition from the united crews of the Centurion, the Gloucester, and the Trial, which, when we departed England, consisted altogether of near 1,000 hands. Deaths from accident were much rarer than those by disease, but the narrative makes the accidental deaths more palpable. During shore leave, a falling tree killed one sailor. A sea lion killed another. A third died from drowning. The story of the drowning victim is heart-wrenching. Working to keep the ship safe during a hellacious storm, this seaman was washed overboard. Those who could see him in the water below were helpless to save him. We perceived that notwithstanding the prodigious agitation of the waves, he swam very strong, and it was with the utmost concern that we found ourselves incapable of assisting him. Indeed, we were the more grieved at his unhappy fate as we lost sight of him struggling in the waves and conceived from the manner in which he swam that he might continue sensible for a considerable time longer of the horror attending his irretrievable situation. Despite the tremendous loss of life, what becomes evident throughout Anson's voyage is the endurance of the survivors, men who never give up in the face of death, who rise to the occasion to do what their commander orders, to do whatever must be done to keep the ships afloat and sustain their war against the Spanish, regardless of hardship and despair. Anson's voyage stirred the emotions of many 18th-century readers, George Washington included. Lawrence Eckard's Gazetteer's or Newsman's Interpreter and Patrick Gordon's Geography Anatomized, two other works Washington acquired in his late teens, reinforced his interest in geography. Eckard designed his book for all readers who frequent coffee houses and other places for news. The emergence of the newspaper as a medium of communication created the need for geographical knowledge. It did no good for a newspaper contributor to tell readers what was happening in other parts of the world if they did not know where those other parts were. A small format book printed with 2 columns per page, Eckard's work made a convenient pocket reference, but it was not without drawbacks. In the all-too-brief entry for Virginia, the 1751 edition of Eckard's Gazetteer identifies Jamestown as the chief city in the colony. When it came to Virginia geography, Eckard was several decades out of date. But misinformation can become information in retrospect. Eckard's Gazetteer reveals how spotty British knowledge of the American colonies was in the mid-18th century. Gordon's Geography Anatomized, the standard school textbook in the field, could be found throughout the American colonies. Washington owned the 19th edition, printed in 1749. His surviving copy is a handsome volume, complete with a rubricated title page and several fold-out maps drawn by the London atlas maker John Senex. Clearly, Washington's study of geography continued after his formal schooling had ended. The most distinctive feature of Gordon's textbook is his set of geographical paradoxes. Gordon presents a list of seemingly anomalous descriptions and asks readers to identify where on earth those strange phenomena occurred. He sought to startle readers as a way of provoking their curiosity and prompting them to learn more about geography by unraveling the paradoxes he presented. Among many others, Gordon's paradoxes include the following. There is a certain island in the Baltic Sea to whose inhabitants the body of the sun is clearly visible in the morning before he ariseth, and likewise in the evening after he is set. Nowhere in his textbook did Gordon provide an answer key, but he did explain the omission. We think it not fit to pull off the visor or expose those masked truths to public view, since to endeavor the unmasking of them may prove a private diversion, both pleasant and useful to the ingenious reader. Of course, there may be another reason why Gordon omitted an answer key. Some of these paradoxes are impossible to solve. The places they describe do not exist. They are what one modern reader calls Borgesian places, lands of legend that remain the province of the imagination. Though these elusive places may only exist beyond the realm of physical geography, they provoke the thought of many students. They may not have extended their geographic knowledge, but they did wonders for their imagination. A different work helped Washington further his geographical study, Herman Maul's Atlas Minor. The foremost cartographer of his day, Maul may be best known to students of English literature for the maps he made for Robinson Crusoe. His maps also inspired those in Gulliver's Travels. In Atlas Minor, Maul included a set of 62 maps illustrating every part of the known world, including some detailed maps of North America. Maul's atlas, typically found in only the finest libraries of the day, gave Washington's collection an aura of class and sophistication. Except for Maul, Washington's teenage set of travel books and geographies was fairly typical of the times. Many readers in the colonial South read the same works, which could be found in libraries throughout the Chesapeake region. Reading these books of travel and geography, Washington familiarized himself with some of the same books his friends and neighbors read. His growing geographical knowledge gave him a font of ideas he could interject in polite conversation among worldly and well-read friends. Closely related to books of travel, the novels in Washington's library also fueled his spirit of adventure. Novels were not his favorite kind of reading. Though Lord Fairfax influenced his literary tastes, Washington owned far fewer novels than his lordship. The novels Washington did own closely resemble his books of travel in terms of both plot and organization. Andrew Michael Ramsay structured Travels of Cyrus, a heavily didactic novel, as a journey relating its hero's adventures among the Magi and the Greeks. Travels of Cyrus, in Benjamin Franklin's words, is full of fine reflections, moral and political. The journey motif made all the instructive material easier for readers to assimilate. In The History of Tom Jones, Henry Fielding sent his picaresque hero on a series of adventures crisscrossing the English countryside, and the eponymous hero of Tobias Smollett's Adventures of Peregrine Pickle takes an extended tour of Europe. The travel elements of these novels gave Washington further information about the places their heroes visited, and the episodic plots propelled their adventuresome heroes from one exciting locale to the next. The travel books, geographies, and novels within young Washington's life are so fascinating that it is tempting to give them too much attention. But they must be read in relation to other aspects of his life. Though he enjoyed reading, he was no bookman. Books were never his first priority. Other activities typically took precedence. Books about different lands occupied much less time than his own land did, that is, the land he surveyed and the properties he acquired. From the time he became official surveyor for Culpeper County, Washington accepted as many surveying jobs as he could. He gained sufficient knowledge and earned enough money from surveying to start investing in land himself, a lifelong passion. From 1749 into 1751, he spent much time at Mount Vernon with his half-brother. Lawrence Washington had a lot to teach George, provided his health held out. He was suffering from consumption. His physician recommended he travel to Barbados, where the renowned Dr. William Hillary practiced medicine. If anyone could save him, Dr. Hillary could. Lawrence asked George to accompany him. Doing so would temporarily halt his career as a surveyor, but George, who was devoted to his brother, agreed to go. Besides helping Lawrence, George would have an opportunity to travel, to enjoy the kinds of experiences he had so far only read about in books. An important event in George Washington's life, the trip also has ramifications for the history of the Caribbean. Their decision to visit Barbados marks a crucial shift in the historical perception of the region. People formerly perceived the Caribbean climate as dangerous and disease-ridden. Going to Barbados, the Washington brothers were among the earliest who traveled from the American mainland to the Caribbean for health reasons. George apparently studied for the trip ahead of time, reading Colonel Fairfax's copy of Griffith Hughes's Natural History of Barbados. A beautifully printed and illustrated book, Hughes's Natural History contains several engraved plates. The page design of the volume is also quite handsome. Marginal glosses guide readers through the work, and quotations from poetry leaven the scientific discourse. Natural History of Barbados is very much a celebration of the genre. Whereas history and biography often concern people's duplicitous behavior and violent passions, natural history celebrates health, pleasure, and serenity. In retrospect, the literary aspects of Hughes's natural history may be more notable than the scientific ones. Hughes had an in-depth knowledge of classical literature, but his scientific expertise seems more superficial. Though Hughes's natural history is not considered an important contribution to scientific knowledge, George Washington, as the reference to the work in his journal shows, learned much about Barbados from reading Hughes. Lawrence and George Washington sailed the last week of September 1751. The voyage was trying. 37 days would pass before they reached Barbados. The diary Washington kept shows a much greater sense of purpose than the journal of his trip to the Shenandoah. Though the manuscript is severely damaged, the surviving parts of Washington's Barbados journal contain more detail than his earlier one. He began keeping a diary in narrative form, but a few days into the trip switched to maintaining a log in chart form. Washington's daily chart does contain some narrative elements, a few with literary pretensions. One entry characterizes the sea as the fickle and merciless ocean. Washington's words echo a phrase given currency by Nancy's Complaint, a popular song that concludes, "Think not of the merciless ocean, my soul any terror can have, for soon as the ship makes its motion, so soon shall the sea be my grave." George continued his journal once they reached Barbados, switching from chart back to narrative form. He recorded the people they met, the places they went, and the things they did. Overall, its contents show what he learned from the travel literature he had read. On Tuesday, November 5th, they consulted Dr. Hillary, a distinguished physician who had studied at Leiden under Hermann Boerhaave. Hillary gave Lawrence hope for recovery, yet recommended he and his brother take a house in the country, advice that reflects Hillary's belief in the environmental concept of disease, that unhealthy air and putrid water cause many illnesses. They rode beyond Bridgetown city limits that evening to find a house. Constructed of stone, consisting of fossilized coral, the house they found had a quaint look to their eyes, but the surrounding scenery offered a sense of grandeur. George wrote that they were perfectly enraptured with the beautiful prospect. The cane, the corn, and the fruit trees were all a delightful green, a color those Virginians were unused to seeing in November. The house had a commanding view of Carlisle Bay, so they could watch the flutter and flash of sails as the boats came and went. The first 2 weeks of November were refreshing. One day they enjoyed the greatest bunch of fruit George had ever seen, granadilla, guava, lemon, orange, pomegranate, and sapodilla. George also enjoyed avocado, and pineapple quickly became a favorite too. He tasted the forbidden fruit, a rare citrus fruit not dissimilar to grapefruit, which is now nearly extinct. George recorded nothing more about fruit in Barbados, forbidden or otherwise, in his journal, explaining, "There are many delicious fruits in this, but as they are particularly described by the Reverend Mr. Hughes in the Natural History of the Island, I shall say nothing further." Brief as it is, Washington's comment reveals much about his attitude toward keeping a journal. He understood writing as a communal task. A travel journal situates its author within a community of writers, past and present. Though writing about his own experience, Washington saw no need to repeat what previous authors had written. He only needed to record new information. When his personal experience coincided with that of an author he had read, he did not bother recording it. For Washington, writing and reading were complementary activities. What he read in Hughes's Natural History of Barbados affected what he wrote in his journal. As a genre in which he excelled, the travel journal would continue to form an important part of Washington's literary life. In addition to the natural aspects of Barbados, Washington enjoyed its man-made features. As one of Britain's most valuable colonial possessions, Barbados was well fortified. Washington studied the entrenchments erected to protect against enemy invasions, and he visited Charles Fort on Needham's Point, which guarded the entrance to Carlisle Bay. He described the fortifications in his journal, counting the number of guns and batteries. Charles Fort was the first fort Washington had ever seen. Washington further enhanced his literary life in Barbados by attending the theater. On Thursday, November 15th, he witnessed a performance of George Lillo's The London Merchant, or The History of George Barnwell. The first play Washington is known to have seen, the Bridgetown performance of George Barnwell, sparked a fascination with the stage that would last a lifetime. Recording the performance in his diary, Washington wrote, "The character of Barnwell and several others was said to be well performed." Notably, Washington recorded the opinion of others instead of making his own critical remarks. Either he thought that it was more important to record the impression of others, or he lacked confidence in his own critical powers. As the play that triggered Washington's love of the theater, George Barnwell is strangely appropriate. Having premiered in London 2 decades earlier, George Barnwell is a landmark in the history of British drama. It introduced the genre of domestic tragedy. Lillo's play eschewed the long-standing notion that a tragic hero must be an aristocratic figure. dramatizing the life of a merchant, Lillo essentially democratized tragedy. Despite its tragic ending, George Barnwell celebrates the world of commerce and the men who made their way in it. 2 days after attending the theater, George Washington was afflicted, or in his words, strongly attacked, with smallpox. The disease left him pockmarked, yet it also immunized him. No longer would he need to worry about contracting the disease. He could walk among the sick the rest of his life and not worry that smallpox would strike him down. What Tobias Smollett said about Godfrey, the brave young soldier in Peregrine Pickle, equally applies to Washington. The scars of the smallpox, of which he bore a good number, added a peculiar manliness to the air of his countenance. Though George recovered from smallpox by mid-December, Lawrence's condition had improved little, if at all, since their arrival. Lawrence would leave Barbados for Bermuda. George would return to Virginia. On Sunday, December 22nd, George boarded the Industry, which weighed anchor and left Carlisle Bay that morning. The downtime aboard ship let him catch up his journal. He wrote about the people, agriculture, government, and commerce of Barbados, and described additional curiosities. On Christmas Eve, for instance, he wrote, "A fresh gale, or what in this part of the world is called a fiery breeze, hurried us past the Leeward Islands." He enjoyed such quaint local sayings. Though the phrase "fiery breeze" circulated in the vernacular of the West Indies, perhaps no one had recorded it before. Washington made sure to do so. Toward the end of January 1752, he touched the Virginia shore and continued to Williamsburg, where he delivered some papers to Governor Dinwiddie. Nearing 60 and quite fat, Robert Dinwiddie looked as imposing as he was. A native of Scotland, he had attended the University of Glasgow, where he received an excellent education, as anyone might guess by his library at the governor's palace. Washington was starting to realize that a man's library could tell others who he was. Dinwiddie's library indicated his curiosity about many different fields of study: ecclesiastical history, ethics, history, poetry, religion, and science. After graduating from college, Dinwiddie had followed the path of many of his countrymen and entered the transatlantic mercantile trade. The British colonies intrigued him to such an extent that he settled in Bermuda, where he became one of the island's leading citizens. Appointed Surveyor General for the Royal Customs for the Southern District of North America in 1738, Dinwiddie oversaw the Bahamas, Jamaica, and the mainland colonies from Pennsylvania southwards. The position entitled him to a seat on the Virginia Council, which he attended sporadically. In 1751, he became Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. Traditionally, the Lieutenant Governor served as the working Governor of Virginia. He was the one who settled in the colony and assumed the day-to-day administrative tasks, while the Royal Governor remained in England, doing little save collecting a fat salary. After meeting Governor Dinwiddie, Washington returned to Mount Vernon to resume his surveying career. As it turned out, Lawrence's trip to Bermuda did nothing to improve his health. His consumption only grew worse. There seemed to be nothing he could do about it. In June, he returned to Virginia, where his condition deteriorated rapidly. On July 25, 1752, Lawrence Washington passed away. With his death, George not only lost a brother, he lost a friend, a mentor, and a father figure.